Good morning, everyone, and welcome. Welcome to the people sitting in the pews. It's lovely to see you all. Welcome to those joining us on the web camera and to those who happen to listen in at a later date. Say good morning to Bill, Ida, and if Jean Marie and anyone else in America is listening to us, you're very welcome. We begin with our opening words. It happens all the time in heaven, and someday it will begin to happen again on the earth, that men and women who are married, and men who are lovers, and women who give each other light, will get down on their knees, and while holding their lover's hand, with tears in their eyes, will speak sincerely, saying, "How can I be more loving to you? How can I be more kind?" This time of the year is very conscious of the need for peace in the world. So this morning we're going to light our chalice in honor of peace. And then the words of David Thoreau, "This is the way to peace. Live each season as it passes. Breathe the air, drink the drink, taste the fruit, and resign yourself to allow the earth to influence you." We have our first hymn this morning, and it's hymn number 26. Holy, 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 author of creation. Hymn number 26. Let us pray. Let us celebrate life right now. Let us bask in the sunlight, swim in cold waters, lie in the grass and look at the sky. Let us close our eyes and travel in the sounds of nature. Let us smell the joyous perfume of flowers and sit beneath the branches of an ancient tree. Let us meditate on the beauty of a single flower in full bloom. Let us share in the laughter of children. Let us feel the love of those who really care about us. Let us enjoy the knowledge that we have played a part in enabling others to flourish. Let us give thanks for the astonishing, unlikely privilege of being fully alive at this moment, in this place, at this time. Let us celebrate God's evolving creation as spring unfolds. Amen. Now, can we say together words that are in the back of our hymn book that attempt to articulate the aims of us, our community? Love is the doctrine of this church. The quest of truth is its sacrament, and service is its prayer. To dwell together in peace, to seek knowledge in freedom, to serve mankind in fellowship, to the end that all souls shall grow in harmony with the divine. This do we covenant with each other and with God. Our reader this morning is Denise.
Good morning. I'm not quite sure how I came across this book, but it's by Catherine Mannix, and it's called Listen, and it's how to find the words for tender conversations. She's specifically chosen the word tender rather than difficult, because there's lots of different contexts in which these conversations happen, some being more difficult or painful, or maybe joyous, depending on how the conversation goes. And I just want to read, it's just from the introduction of the book. I can't find the words. Right now, there's likely to be a conversation you are trying to avoid. It's probably one that's important to you, but has a quality of discomfort to it. Perhaps the conversation requires sharing of a difficult truth, inquiring about information that may be life-changing, proposing something that risks rejection, discussing a topic that will unleash strong emotions, consoling someone experiencing sorrow. There's a push-pull of commitment, the need to act, and yet the fear of vulnerability. Not just yet. Soon, but not just yet. I will call or visit or make the appointment. We stand on the brink, unsure of how to begin. We all have moments when words fail us. This is often because the words we need are swirling in a fog of emotions. Sometimes leaving them hidden sometimes seems more appealing than taking the risk of putting a distressing situation into words. There are moments when a look, a touch, a shrug, a nod might communicate better than words. A hug, a clasp of a hand, a pat on the arm may speak volumes. Some of us are more comfortable than others with physical gestures. Sometimes we might offer a cup of tea, a handkerchief, or a companionable silence. But eventually there comes a time for words, and then the word finding difficulty begins. Perhaps we know what we want to convey, but words feel inadequate. Perhaps we wish we could talk about something important to us, but we fear become emotional in speaking of it. We may want to ask a question, yet fear it will seem intrusive or insensitive. Maybe it's bad news that needs to be broken, and we dread the distress that we will cause in pursuing the task. The skills involved in important conversations are nuanced and layered. They are not tools to be used one at a time, but are more like the movements you make in a dance: stepping, turning, pausing, changing direction, and keeping in time with the music as we move together around the dance floor. A bit like salsa dancing, conversations need at least two people for participants to join in and take turns. Perhaps one person is leading and yet not forcing. Perhaps one is following and yet not under pressure. As a dancer conversation continues, the roles of leader and follower may swap in the same way that a dance progresses using steps forwards and backwards, sharing and preserving the space. A conversation includes words and silences, speaking and listening. statements and questions. There's consent and there's partnership. There's no right way to hold a conversation about matters that are serious or sorrowful or embarrassing, but there are some wrong ways. Getting it wrong is often not about the words themselves, but about the dance. Insisting on instead of inviting a discussion, speaking lots and listening little, if at all, raised voices and too little silence, speaking without consent or at the wrong time or to get it over with rather than to explore. These occasions when we get it wrong cannot be undone, but we can learn from them. Like dancing, we can understand why we tripped up and know how to tread more gracefully next time, how to keep our balance, how to lean on or support each other as we progress, and when we move forwards, when to step backwards, and when to trust our hearts and simply follow the music.
As ever, we have a children's story, and this is a story, it's attributed to Socrates. Who knows whether or not it was Socrates who came up with it, but I have a feel, I hope he did, let's put it that way. And it's Socrates and one of his students, and the student comes back, he's been down at the market, and he comes up to Socrates and he says, "Socrates, I was down the market. You won't believe what I heard about your friend Glaucon." And Socrates immediately is suspicious of hearing things from the market or anywhere else. So he says to his student, "Right, before you tell me anything, you have to pass the test whether I want to hear this." And the student says, "What test?" He says, "Well, there's three parts in it. So the first part is, is this true?" And the student says to him, "Well, everybody in the market is saying that it is true." And Socrates says, "But do you know it's true?" And he says, "No, but everybody is saying it." He says, "Okay, so we don't know if it's true." The second one is, The second one is, "Will it do me any good?" You know? And I can't remember the third one. It's just going out of my head. But the test is so relevant today. It might come back to me. It's so relevant today because of social media. How often do we read things on social media? Oh yeah, The second one is it something good about my friend Glaucon? Is it good news about him? And he says, "Oh no, that's not what it is at all." And the third one then is it going to do me any good? And that's attributed to Socrates. Possibly never said it. But when you think of social media today, it's wonderful. It has its place. But it hurts people. And if Socrates could have listened to that story and not passed it on, but it would have damaged him and damaged what he thought about his friend. So maybe when we read things on social media, before we even open it, we ask those three questions. Is this true? Do I know for certain it's true? Is it something good about the person? You know, why do you want to know only nasty things? And three, will it do you good at the end of having heard it? I hope Socrates said it. Thank you. We're going to have our second hymn now, and it's hymn number 92, "Mysterious Presence, Source of All." Hymn number 92.
Thank you.
During the week, there was a great deal of talk in the media about war in Europe. And they keep saying it's the first time since the Second World War that there has been war in the land of Europe. We've forgotten that there was a war in Europe in the 1990s in what was now the former Yugoslavia. And this reading is about war, and it's by a lady called Susan McCain, and it's called Bittersweet. It's May the 28th, 1992, and Sarajevo is under siege. For centuries, Muslims, Croats, and Serbs have lived together in this city that stretches city of streetcars and pastry shops, gliding swans and parkland ponds, Ottoman mosque and Eastern Orthodox cathedrals. A city of three religions, three peoples. Yet until recently, no one paid too much attention to who was who. They knew, but they didn't know. They preferred to see one another as neighbours who met for coffee or kebabs, took classes at the same university, sometimes got married and had children. But now it was civil war. Men on the hills flanking the city have cut the electricity and water supply. The 1984 Olympic Stadium has been burned down. Its playing fields are now turned over to makeshift graveyards. The apartment buildings are pockmarked from mortar assaults. The traffic lights are broken. The streets are quiet. The only sound, the crackling of gunfire. The strains of Abellini's Adagio in G major fill the pedestrian street outside a bombed-out bakery. The music is haunting. It's exquisite. It's infinitely sad. The player is the lead cellist in the Sarajevo Opera Orchestra, and he's playing it in honor of 22 people killed yesterday by a mortar shell as they lined up queuing for bread. He was nearby when the shell exploded, and he helped to care for the wounded. Now he's returned to the scene of the carnage, dressed as if for a night at the opera house in a formal white shirt and black tails. He sits amidst the rubble on a white plastic chair, a cello propped between his legs. The yearning notes of the adagio float up to the sky. All around him, the rifles are firing, the shelling booms, the machine guns crackle. He keeps on playing. And he'll do this for another 21 days. One day for each person killed in the bakery. Somehow the bullets never touch him. This is a city built in a valley, ringed by mountains from which snipers aim at the starving citizens in search of bread. Some people wait for hours to cross the street and then dart across like hunted deer. And here's a man sitting in the open square, dressed in concert finery as if he has all the time in the world. You ask me, am I crazy to sit playing cello in a war zone, he says. Why can't you ask them if they're crazy for shelling Sarajevo? His gesture reverberates throughout the city, over the airwaves. Soon it'll find expression in a novel and a film. But before that, during the darkest days of the siege, he will inspire other musicians to take to the streets with their own instrument. They don't play martial music to rouse the troops against the snipers or pop music to lift the people's spirits. They play the adagio. The attackers attack with guns and bombs, and the musicians respond with the most bittersweet music they know. We are not combatants, called the violinists. We are not victims either, add the violas. We're just humans, sing the cellos. Just humans, flawed and beautiful and aching for love and peace. A few months later, the civil war rages on, and the foreign correspondent, Alan Little, watches as a procession of 40,000 civilians emerge from a forest. They've been trudging to the woods for 48 hours straight, fleeing an attack. Little asks an elderly 80-year-old man who looks desperately exhausted. The man approaches Little and asks, has he seen his wife? They had become separated during the long march, and the man says, Little tells him he hasn't seen her, but ever the journalist, he asks whether the man wouldn't mind identifying himself as a Muslim or a Croat. And the man's answer haunts him even now. He said, I am a magician. A musician. Wars don't really change, but we do forget too soon. Now we will have a time of prayer. This will be brought to an end by a piece of music. And this is to allow everyone to remember their own thoughts, prayers, and concerns. Eternal Spirit of life and love, who am I really? What is my story? As I reflect on my history, I'm aware of some of the things, some of the events, some of the people who have made me as I am. I give thanks that my future is not set in stone. There's a new me possible. Change can happen, though the me is still me. The same, but slightly different. May I have faith to change, to bring head, heart and hand in unison a little more often. May I have hope in the future me, the glorious possibilities of the rest of my life. May I fulfill the gift of my life. May I have love, above all love, to give, to experience, and to share with a bruised and hurting world. The title of this morning's address is the Apostle Paul. The Apostle Paul is one of the most controversial figures in Christianity. In any discussion of human sexuality, someone will invariably quote Saint Paul. He can be accused of being homophobic, anti-Semitic, and misogynistic. In his writing, Paul does seem to condemn homosexual acts. He does say that the Jewish people are blind when it comes to interpreting their own scriptures. And he does say that women should be silent in church. But Paul also wrote, "Three things remain: faith, hope, and love, and the greatest of these is love." His other great contribution is that he advised his communities, when they are discussing a problem, they should ask themselves, what would Jesus do in this situation? And then his other contribution that I like was that we see things but darkly. In other words, we don't have all the answers. And how different the world would be if humanity remembered that love is the greatest virtue. How differently humans would act if they asked themselves, how would Jesus behave in these circumstances? And if we remembered that we don't have all the answers. Paul is such a towering figure in the Christian story that he's often referred to as the apostle. No name, just the apostle. So it's easy to forget that he wasn't one of the 12 original disciples chosen by Jesus. He never met Jesus while Jesus lived. We know that he was a persecutor of the Christians. He had what is called his conversion experience. And this experience changed him from being a persecutor of Christians to becoming a follower of Jesus. In his lifetime, Paul traveled most of what was then the known world to spread the message of Jesus. To try to understand Paul, it is important to remember that Paul was a Pharisee, and Pharisees were the strictest sect within the Jewish religion. He was a Roman citizen, and he was born in Tarsus, which was part of the Greek world. Being born a Jew outside of Judea, a Roman citizen, and having been brought up in Greek culture are important elements in his story. As a Pharisee, Paul believed that anyone hanged on a tree was cursed by God. That's in the book of Deuteronomy. So Paul then said, how could the followers of Jesus proclaim that Jesus was the Messiah? He had been hanged on a tree. He was on the cross. It was his deep Jewish faith that made Paul a persecutor of Christians. And it was his deep faith in Jesus that made him a champion of his message. So Paul never did things in half measures. He always committed himself fully. There are three accounts of Paul's conversion experience in the New Testament, and each one of them is slightly different. Later, Paul claimed that the risen Jesus had appeared to him. But unfortunately for us, Paul does not give details of these life-defining experiences. He just says they happened, but he doesn't tell us the nitty-gritty details. Then, as now, people either love Paul or hate him. Paul is particularly important in Reformed Christianity, and yet Paul's writings have caused dreadful divisions within the Protestant traditions. You have one lot who read one part of Paul and said, yes, we are saved by grace. You have the Calvinists then who said, but look at here, God can decide whether or not he's going to send you to heaven or hell before you're ever even born. And that's that predestination. So really, really divisive person. There's one writer of Paul who's written a book, St. Paul A.N. Wilson is his name, and he said that Christianity could more appropriately be called the religion of Paul. And I used to think that, now I slightly disagree. Paul's writings are the earliest surviving Christian writings. They predate the Gospels. The New Testament is a very slim part of any Bible. Most of it is taken up with the Jewish scriptures. And the majority of the New Testament is Paul's work or work that is attributed to him. In the Gospels and the other books of the New Testament, those writers are anonymous. We don't know anything about them. We don't know anything about Matthew or Mark or Luke. They don't tell us anything personally. They just narrate. However, in Paul's writing, his personality seems to leap from the letters. He begins one letter with, I'm amazed at your behavior about something. You know, Paul's personality seems to leap out of us at us. At times he is angry, exasperated, cajoling. Money is an issue with Paul. He's very like Father Ted. The collection he made to support the, as they call it, the saints in Jerusalem, arrives in Jerusalem by a very circuitous route. In his letter to the Corinthians, he claims, I don't ask for money for my preaching. He's taken this as a great thing. You know, I'm allowed to ask for it. I don't ask you to give me money. I do it for free. But he didn't tell the Corinthians that the Macedonian church were paying him already. You know, he was a bit slippery when it came to money. A second century Christian writer gives us a description of Paul. He said he was a man of middling size, his hair was scanty, and his legs were a little crooked, and his knees were wide apart. He had a large nose, and his eyebrows met, and his nose was somewhat long. We seem to have an awful lot of information about Paul. But that changes when we realize that new discoveries about Greek archaeology and culture changes what we think we know. Recent discoveries show that Paul was trained in Greek rhetoric. And rhetoric was a formal way of writing and debating. When Paul wrote a letter, he was following a set formula. According to Greek rhetoric, when something was good, the writer had to appear happy. When they were making a complaint, the writer was to be angry and show their anger. And funnily, that physical description of Paul is a classic description of a Greek leader. Whenever a Greek leader is being described, that description is used. It's like when we talk about, someone mentions, he was very handsome. He was tall, dark, and handsome. We never say small, attractive, and blonde. We say tall, dark, and handsome. That's what that description of him was. When Paul had his conversion experience, I think in our mind we think that he converted to being a Christian. But there was no Christian church at that time. There were small groups of Jesus followers scattered around Jerusalem and Judea. These were people who believed that Jesus was the promised Jewish Messiah. Paul joined one of these communities and later went on to work spreading the message. He travelled in the Greek world, where he preached in the synagogues and founded communities based in cities. And when the community was established, Paul moved on to establish another group. So that we forget that it wasn't an existing church Paul joined. It wasn't another church that he founded. So at that time, there was no official church teaching of what it meant to be a follower of Jesus. So when he left the groups he founded, invariably questions would arise. You know, well, what do we do in this situation? For example, one was, if you were Jewish, if you weren't Jewish, could you join? Or did you have to become Jewish and then become part of the group? Could you eat with people who weren't Jewish? Could Jews and non-Jews meet together to share bread and wine? All those sort of questions had to be answered. And when a question arose, the community wrote to Paul asking for advice. What do we do with this situation? And Paul's letters that we have are his responses to their queries. It was a two-way correspondence, but we have only one side of the correspondence available to us. Paul never sat down and wrote a treatise on what it is to be a Christian. He was advising on particular problems in his communities. We only have one side of the correspondence. We don't know what the questions were that Paul was answering. And yet we try to solve modern problems, not even knowing what the questions he was answering, using his letters. One of his letters, it is said, is an amalgamation of five different letters can be picked out. Someone once asked at a lecture, how do academics know this? And the response was, well, if you were reading Barbara Cartland romance and then you were reading Jane Austen, if you amalgamated the two, you'd know they were different. The language is different. The words used are different. The syntax is different. So care must be taken with his writings. You can't take a sound bite from one and apply it to every situation. In Corinthians 1, chapter 6, verse 9 to 11, we have Paul's so-called condemnation of homosexuality. Now, there's another one, but we won't go into that. But in that so-called condemnation of homosexuality, the sentence also continues with he condemns idolaters, adulterers, thieves, the greedy, drunkards, slanderers, and swindlers. They're all on a par. And nobody ever said, well, he swindled, or he was dishonest, or he was drunk. He's not going to heaven. Very few Irish in heaven, if that's the case. What about Paul's attitude to women? Paul did indeed say women should be silent in church. Yet, on the other hand, women held leadership roles within Paul's communities. When he wrote to some of those people, he mentioned the women by names and greeted them by name in the letters. But listen, like us, Paul was of his time, his culture, and his life experience. Just because he has come down to us doesn't mean he was without his faults. As a Roman citizen, Paul would have grown up steeped in Roman and Greek traditions where women were relegated to the home. They were never expected to go outside their home. Today, we have the expression, the decadent days of the Roman Empire. We think that they were always having orgies and all the thing. However, the Emperor Augustus, in his reign of 27 years, passed morality laws. And these laws were enforced. They weren't just on the statute books, they were enforced. Augustus exiled his daughter because of her adultery. Augustus was still alive in Paul's lifetime. So you can say that Paul was brought up with a very Victorian moral attitude, possibly even more strict than the Victorians. And we know social change develops only gradually. Just think about it. Slavery was abolished in 1865 in America. Still fighting to achieve equality between African Americans and white Americans. Attitudes do not change overnight. The fact that women were active in the early church is really remarkable for that time. And from his writings, we do know that the church in Corinth was noted by the spiritual gifts of its members, the prophecies, the healed, the spoken tongues. Those Christians must have been the talk of the neighborhood. Talking in tongues means just continuous stream of unintelligible rubbish coming out of your mouth. I remember speaking once with a guy who was once a born-again Christian, and I said to him, you know, did you ever speak in tongues? And he says, oh, yeah. I said, was that not very hard? He said, it's so easy when you get into it. He says, the problem is stopping yourself. So can you imagine a load of women out in public going to a meeting and behaving like this? It's also possible when you think like that, that Paul was being protective of that church. He was saying to the women, maybe tone it down a bit. Another example is how we change, how attitudes change. In the 1990s, in the early 1990s, this church was between ministers, and a discussion was held about whether or not they would be happy to have a minister who happened to be gay. And they thought, well, we're not quite ready for that yet. Now, if somebody came along to be the minister here and they were gay, wouldn't bat an eyelid. But that's taken us 30 years to grow and to change. In some Christian communities, Paul's instructions are still used to deny the women a full role in their community. His words are taken out of context and used to hurt other groups. Paul was inspired by his new faith. He was also a fallible human being, a man of his times. His writings must be interpreted in the context in which they are written, in the knowledge that they are an incomplete source. In the first letter to the Corinthians, and there was a second letter, the first one he said, when I wrote to you beforehand, so we know at least one letter is missing. We need to remember all of those warnings. And also to remember his words about, we don't even know what the questions he was answering were. And some of his work still speaks very true. The greatest virtue is love. In any situation, if we ask, what would Jesus do? certainly would never get answered that question was burn them at the stake. And remember that we do not understand everything. Amen.